Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect welcomes to the show Catherine Boyce Parker, lawyer for Johnston case where homeless people, the right for them to sleep with shelter in Cridge Park was questioned and taken to the BC Supreme Court. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff.
You had some things to say to us about the city's attitude. We played some files about the city's attitude and people's reaction to it. I gather that the city was not popular, its take on the problem.
Well, I think that, you know, what's really important about this decision is that it sort of recognizes that when the city makes laws, it has to take into account the impact of those laws on the people who live on the street. And it recognizes that the Constitution does protect the rights of the people who have very little. It's not just, the Charter's not just about abstract things like freedom of expression, it's about protecting the right to shelter. And Madam Justice Ross held that the right to shelter was a basic human right and necessity of life that was protected by Section 7. Now, the city has a lot of people that are working on the homeless problem and have been for some time, and we're hoping that what happens as a result of this decision is everybody pulls together to up with a solution that respects the rights of the public to enjoyment of the parks and the rights of homeless people to be able to keep themselves safe and secure from the weather.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that here.
Somebody mentioned to me if the city of Victoria has vacant land that approximates parkland, could they not designate it for homeless use? I'm not putting that forward as my solution, but it, somebody remarked it, and I thought, well, you know, that sounds like a distinct possibility. Is that not on, or is that under consideration?
Well, we haven't heard from the city, so we only know what we read in the papers, but I read today that the city was going to meet to discuss a number of possibilities, including whether they were going to designate some land that could be used or whether they were going to enact new regulations that would restrict how much, how long the tents could be up or something like that, or and as well consider the possibility of an appeal.
Okay.
So it sounds like they are beginning to look at all their options, and I think that's exactly what the court expected them to do.
Oh, good. Yeah, you mentioned that the court ruling didn't restrict their options in any fundamental way. It just told them that they had to use some options.
That's right. I mean, what was at issue in this case was an absolute prohibition on putting up any form of overhead shelter any place in the city. And when deciding that that was unconstitutional, the judge took special note of the fact that it was an absolute prohibition, not tailored to any particular objectives that the city might be wishing to achieve. You know, because of the number of homeless here in Victoria and the lack of shelter beds, there isn't any question that there will be people sleeping outside. So the question is not whether or not there will be people sleeping on public space, but what sort of shelter they can create. And any regulation of that has to go to, you know, the impact of the shelter itself.
So meaning?
Well, what she found was a lot of the city's justifications for why they said they prohibited overnight shelters, such as trampling bushes or you know, the fact that it's unsightly to have people sleeping in the park. A lot of that arises not from the fact that people might have tents in the park, but because they have homeless people in the park.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that's going to exist until that problem is solved.
Right.
So, you know.
So the judge basically gave it back to the people with the power to solve it.
That's right. In deciding what remedy to create, to give us, she said, well, I'm just going to say that this bylaw, as currently drafted, is of no force and effect insofar as it prohibits homeless people from setting up shelter, and I'm going to leave it to City Council to decide how they do want to regulate this in a way consistent with people's constitutional rights.
Is this going to result in a redistribution of the homeless people? You mentioned to me that they were having to resort to some pretty covert measures to find shelter when they didn't have homes. Are they going to come back out in the open now?
Well, I certainly hope that, you know, the homeless people are able to provide themselves with some sort of shelter that's safe, not only from the elements, but from some of the other risks that homeless people face on the streets. You know, we hear a lot about crime associated with homelessness, but what you don't often hear is that really homeless people are very, very often the victims of crime.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we heard from the people who were in the tent city 3 years ago here in Victoria was that living together in the open, in tents, allowed them to escape a lot of the risks they faced on the street, a lot of the isolation, a lot of the violence, especially from the young women who were in the tent city. So I'm hoping that if people are allowed to protect themselves with a tent, that it will make them more secure, both from the weather and from other elements.
Well,
now,
not
this
only
may make them more visible, but, you know,
yeah,
it's rendering them invisible is not a solution.
Right. Yeah, good point. I don't imagine that it's only the tent that protects them, because a tent is a pretty fragile barrier, but it's the grouping that protects them, the social construct of a tent city.
That's right. Although I think that the ability to put up a tent sort of legitimizes their existence in a way that requiring them to hide under bridges and under bushes does not.
That's true. It puts up a boundary. It says, I'm here, and this is my space inside, and that's your space outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Do you think it has implications for other cities who are trying to rid themselves of homeless people before they've solved the problem of homelessness?
Well, I think it certainly does have implications. I think what it does is it makes clear that when city councils or provincial legislatures or federal legislatures are enacting measures, they have to take into account how this will impact people. And you can't do what I think this bylaw did before, which was sort of the legislative equivalent of closing your eyes and hoping the problem goes away.
Yeah.
You have to address what the real impact is going to be on the real people on the street.
Okay.
And so I think everybody's got to keep that in mind now when they're enacting laws to address homelessness.
So maybe what this brings home is the Band-Aid nature of all these restrictions and moving these people around and trying to control how they get together. These are all Band-Aids on a real problem that hasn't been solved. And you're saying this court case, this court decision highlights that?
Absolutely. I think the judge very clearly recognized that the current state of the problem of homelessness, and it really has reached crisis proportion as a result of a whole bunch of factors, including the federal withdrawal from housing and the provincial cutbacks to different kinds of support and the lack of services that are being provided. And those issues all need to be addressed before this problem can really be solved. If there was a sufficient number of safe and secure shelter sites, and if people could access the services they needed to from those shelter sites, then you might have gotten a very, very different result in a case like this. And certainly if cities and citizens are concerned about the impact that someone putting up a tent might have on their community, a very straightforward way to solve it is to provide sufficient shelter space.
Yeah, for sure. It looks as if this leaves the door open for the city to say, okay, you can shelter yourself here, but you can't shelter yourself there?
Absolutely, I think it does. I think that there's no doubt that the city can regulate where people can sleep outside. The fact that homeless people have to be able to protect themselves from the elements does not mean that they can sleep wherever they want, whenever they want, and that everybody else's interests have to give way. That's not at all what it means. It just means there has to be some place where they can provide themselves with safe and effective shelter. Now, if the city was to say, well, the only place you can do that is in this very dangerous area or a very mm-hmm. inadequate area, then again, that wouldn't be really recognizing their interests, and so that would be problematic. But as long as there's appropriate and sufficient space allocated, then certainly it would be allowable, I would think, for the city constitutionally to exclude it from certain areas.
Okay. So heavy traffic tourist areas, for instance, they would probably want to exclude. But it strikes me that one of the ways that a city would try to take advantage of this, and I'm not saying Victoria will, but there have been inclinations in the east here that cities are prone to say, oh, yeah, you know, well, we know all your services are downtown, but we would prefer it that you live, you know, like 7-8 miles from downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we'll even provide you with apartments up there. You know, just don't expect soup kitchens and, intervention services and those kinds of things. You know, we're giving you an apartment now, so you're going to take your $560 a month and live there like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it strikes me that in the East here, at any rate, that might be an outcome of this kind of decision.
Well, I think that, you know, one thing the decision makes clear is you have to look at the real impact on the people on the street. So if they're offered an alternative, but the alternative is not realistic for them and doesn't really address their interests, then it may not really be an alternative. The judge talked about, you know, if there were sufficient shelter spaces and people still chose to sleep outside, would the result be any different? And she took into account, well, it sort of depends. If the shelter spaces were truly unsafe, then maybe it still would be a breach of people's rights to say you had to stay in those shelters.
And Judge Ross discussed this.
Yes, she did.
Okay.
So you have to really look at what the actual impact is on the people who are feeling the brunt of these bylaws. But I think the other thing to remember is there is a lot of people that have been working very hard to come up with a lot of creative and useful solutions to the problem of homelessness and all the associated problems that go with the need for integrated services and everything else.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great ideas that are out there. They just need some political will and some funding.
Yeah.
And, this is a problem that can be addressed.
So this decision puts more of an impetus behind that. You know, you're running out of short-term solutions and Band-Aids. The long-term solutions remain. Now the homeless have their right to reject unsafe or dramatically unsuitable housing has been indicated, and it's up to you to provide them with safe and suitable housing.
That's right. You know, I don't know too much about it, but in some jurisdictions, like in Scotland, as I understand it, there was actually a law passed saying that municipalities must provide adequate shelter for all of their homeless populations, and once they were required to do it, they found a way to do it.
Wow. Scotland, eh? I have to dig up my long-distance card and call those people and find out what they've done. It sounds good. Was there anything else you wanted to say to celebrate your win in this ruling and your win for homeless people?
Well, I just, encourage everyone to read the decision carefully and exercise their rights responsibly and take care of each other.
Yeah. Well, you indicated to me that the site was BC Courts, and I did a search, found BC Courts, and this is BC Supreme Court, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And the proper name of the case?
It's City Victoria versus Adams and others.
Versus Adams?
Adams.
Okay. Much appreciated. And thanks
for
taking the time with us today. At least we didn't wake you up at 7 a.m.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Victoria constitutional lawyer Catherine Boyce Parker explain how the right to erect shelters in Victoria's parks was won, the city's response to it. We also have a note in our email about the city's response to it from Way Robinson in Hamilton. Police break up Victoria's tent city. From Pettifong, Western Canada Bureau Chief. Paper's not mentioned, but it's probably a Victoria paper. Days after a judge ruled that homeless people have a right to camp in Victoria's city parks, police moved in to break up a growing tent city near the provincial legislature. 5 people were arrested when some homeless campers refused to take down their tents. Police are enforcing a new bylaw that doesn't prevent camping in public places, but tries to regulate it by only allowing camping overnight. The new bylaw was quickly put into place after a BC Supreme Court judge ruled earlier in the week that Victoria's original bylaw, passed 3 years ago to prohibit erecting a shelter in a public place, was unconstitutional because there aren't enough shelters to house Victoria's homeless. While advocates for the homeless lauded the Tuesday ruling, municipal officials across Canada are watching the decision closely. Within hours of the ruling, tents started going up in Victoria's Beacon Hill Park near the legislature. Camps have since popped up in other city parks. The city is appealing the court ruling, but since the appeal could take up a year to be heard, the municipality rushed in a new policy that allows tents to be used only from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. Dave DeWert, a spokesperson for the activists, said, "There are not enough shelters for the number of homeless, so what are people to do? Currently, if you're outside and you set up shelter for yourself, that's a crime, and it's illegal." Pivot Legal Society, an advocacy legal group in Vancouver's downtown east side, plans to challenge the city's bylaw about setting up shelter. The conditions for people sleeping on the street are worse, and risks are heightened in Winnipeg, said David Stanson, the city's housing development manager. "You're looking at minus 30 degrees here in winter," he said. "I haven't heard of anyone during those times putting up a tent. They're looking for shelters because it's an issue of survival." Cities including Toronto have said that for years there are enough shelter beds for the homeless, said street nurse Kathy Crow, who was arrested after trying to set up a tent city in front of Queen's Park. "This is a brilliant ruling and a very brave stand. It was great news to have, especially after the election," she said. "This ruling puts pressure on all cities in Canada, and with this economic downturn, we know there are going to be many, many more people pushed out onto the streets." And now we'll take a break with Garnet Rogers, Small Victory.
Business buying a mare like that, but buy her if you must. He bit the end off his cigar and spat it in the dust. She's old, she's lame and barren too, she's not worth feed and hay. But I'll give her this, he blew smoke at me, she was something in her day. I recall her well 10 years ago. She was a winner in her prime. She was fast and lean and willing, but they raced her past her time. And though she had the heart, her legs were gone, and it wasn't hard to see. They kept her at it in the hopes of just one more small victory. So she was shunted round from track to track, from Kentucky up to Maine. They'd run her in cheap claimers, all doped up to mask her pain. And if it's my advice you want, I'd say the poor thing's had her day. You'd be throwing good cash after bad, it's best you turned away. Well, they led her around the auction shed, and the bidding started low. She'll go for dog food, someone said, the market's been that slow. But she raised her head and pricked her ears, and before the hammer fell, she was mine. My friend turned round to me, you're soft-headed, I can tell. But she's been shoved from pillar to post, said I, and always done her best. They used her up, they wrung her dry, you'd think she'd earned a rest. So if she does not but end her days beneath some shady tree, I'll have saved her from the knacker's yard, and that's enough for me. Near 2 years ago, she's filled out some since then. The more so since she's been in full, she eats enough for 10. And this morn as I crept to the barn around about 3:30, there stood nursing arms till trembling legs, one more small victory.
Disrespect also spoke last night with Armin Yalnizian, the senior economist for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, about the center's poll showing 90% of Canadians want leaders to do something about poverty in the country, and the center's five-step proposal to the premier how to measure poverty reduction.
Disrespect welcomes Armin Yalnizian, the senior economist for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff.
Thanks for coming on the show in the evening. So many of my guests let me host them in the evening because they're so busy during the day. And I gather you must have been busy with media interviews on the five tests and the results of your poll, your recent poll.
Yeah.
Were the two intertwined?
Actually, they're completely separate projects, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
The five tests is a huge group of concerned citizens who are both the poor themselves and the non-poor and service providers and just individuals that have gotten together in this coalition called 25 and 5, which is seeking a 25% reduction in poverty rates in Ontario over the next 5 years.
Okay.
So that was their five tests, is just to see.
Yeah.
So here's the five tests to see if you're...
Oh, okay. So you said you would do something. Yeah, we'll take you at your word, but we also have a measure to apply.
Yeah, here's the test to see whether you're going to walk the talk.
Okay. And which came first, the poll or the tests?
Definitely the test. Well, I was going to say definitely the test, because that's a long conversation. But in truth, we were putting together a new poll. We were thinking about going to do a new poll. We'd done a poll at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives in the fall of 2006, 2 years ago.
Right.
On what people thought about inequality in this country.
Okay.
You know, they think it's growing, they think it's dropping, do they think that matters
right. If
it's growing, do they think anything can be done about it? And we had been talking about, 2 years later, have opinions changed at all?
Mm-hmm.
And along comes this 25 and 5 coalition that says, there is a real tight relationship between poverty reduction and trying to close the gap. So why don't we ask? And in those 2 years, four different provincial governments drew a line in the sand and said, we're going to do something about this. Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Quebec, and Ontario. And actually, in the last couple of weeks, Manitoba and Nova Scotia, New Brunswick have joined that group.
Okay.
And every single party at the federal level, except the ruling Conservatives, have said, we have to do something about poverty.
Yeah.
So there's been this kind of chattering classes getting all vexed about doing something about poverty reduction. We're not quite sure what.
Right.
And so we thought, instead of redoing a poll on inequality, why don't we focus it on what Canadians think about poverty and what they would like to see done about it, if anything, or if they think their governments can do anything.
Yeah.
And so we went with Environics again, which is, a really well-respected and very large polling company, and they kind of put the choke chain on us a little bit and said, showed us how to make the questions as neutral as possible to truly assess the level of support.
Okay.
Including things like, we're heading into a recession, there may be some trade-offs that are down the pike, you may want these things, but how much would you support these various measures to reduce poverty in the face of a recession? So, frankly, we were working on this thing in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Long before the federal election was called,
and
certainly long before the economic meltdown took place. But the questions were being asked right when all of that was happening.
These are the poll questions at that time.
I'm sorry?
These are the poll questions at that time.
Yeah. So the polling, we'd gone through focus groups across the country to assess, what are the questions, where are the places of controversy? Because if you're going to do a poll, you don't want to find out what everybody already agrees is a no, or what everybody already agrees is a yes.
Right.
You want to ask questions about what's the soft ground? Where might there be some differences? What might we learn by going out and asking questions?
Sure.
So
all of that was going on in the summertime. And so when we went out into the field, here we are from September the 21st to October the 21st asking 2,000 Canadians what they think about these issues, and there's a federal election going on,
right.
And there's an economic meltdown going on.
Exactly, so. Yeah.
It was really...
What did Environics say about the change in context for the poll?
Well, in fact, we didn't change any of the questions other than to say very specifically if there was a recession and there are trade-offs to be made. How do you feel about these things? Because otherwise, the questions pretty much stood as on their own.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the resounding thing, Jeff, was, you know, I guess Stephen Harper got it right in the sense that he thought this was an election about leadership.
Oh.
And what came back loud and clear from the polling questions is Canadians are starved for leadership.
Oh.
And they're saying, make us proud. Do something that really makes a difference in people's lives, that protects all of us from vulnerability, and actually makes a difference for people that have been so hammered by the deficit from 10 years ago and really have not seen much benefit from the last 10 years of blockbuster economic growth. That really shocked me.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was a good time then to do the polling in the sense that people, you know, the issues were foremost in people's mind. The economy had sort of made everybody question their security, and suddenly everybody was aware of what it's like to question your own security. And maybe if you didn't have anything backstopping you, any money or any other kind of support, then maybe people thought this was a bad thing, you know?
Well, do you know, that's actually right on the money, because when you take a look at the financial worry that's expressed at the front end of the poll, it's all about you, right? You start off a questionnaire, and I want to know about you. How do you feel about this and that and the other thing about yourself? Well, those were some pretty... the first one, 47%, almost half of Canadians saying that they were struggling with personal debt. That's a very high level.
Yeah.
Like one out of two people after a decade, again, of spectacular economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
44% were worried about having a comfortable retirement, which is to be expected because, again, the news of, you know, stock market meltdown and what that meant for people's investments and savings plans were high. I was actually surprised that number wasn't a bit higher, actually, given the context.
Might be today, yes.
But the one that really stopped my heart was 39%, almost 4 in 10 Canadians saying that they themselves feel that they're one or two paychecks away from being poor. You know, and everybody was worried about, well, not everybody, 83%, that's pretty close to everybody, worried about the rising cost of living, because we had just come off the summer of gas prices going, who knows, only up, right?
Wheat through the roof.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've come right back down again in the last couple of weeks. But again, starting in the middle of September, those prices just kept going up and up and up on both housing and gas. And people were really freaking about the rising cost of living. And, you know, you put this in context that most people's incomes are not going up.
No.
The average wage has been stagnant for 30 years. That's just as true in the last few years as it has been for the previous three decades.
Wow.
And the people at the bottom are actually losing ground quite dramatically. But what came through loud and clear, and again, with the financial storm clouds south of the border, it's not surprising that there was this huge change in tone, that government action was really the story there.
Yeah.
And whether the Canadians are worried about their own financial situation or not, the resounding majority wants to see both their federal and provincial leaders reduce the number of poor people in Canada, and they want them to act right now.
That's
they see,
exciting.
You know, governments acting to help bankers and acting to help investors.
Yeah.
They want action for people at the bottom. And, you know, the numbers are huge. 90% say it's time for strong leadership to reduce the number of poor people. And, you know, when you say to them, countries like the UK or Sweden targeted poverty reduction and actually made some headway on it.
Yeah.
People say, well, if those countries can do it, 92% of Canadians say, if those countries can do it, why can't we?
Yeah.
Why can a country like Ireland reduce its proportion of the poor?
Yeah.
And Canada, which is the ninth largest economy in the world,
really?
With a fraction of the population, with the strongest economic growth track record in the last decade, the most number of jobs created of any Western nation. We created over 3 million jobs in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, why can't we reduce poverty?
Yeah, it's a good question. But I've never heard it asked before. I'm glad to hear it's being asked now.
Well, I'm glad to hear the Canadians say it's not good enough to say, well, you know, the economy will take care of it, because clearly trickle down doesn't work if there's sponges at the top, and that's what we've been seeing.
Yeah. You've been listening to Armin Yalnizian, the senior economist for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, talking about the recent poll that showed 90% of Canadians expect their leaders to do something about the poor in Canada today. So the province can't let go of their commitment now to poverty, unlike some other commitments which were outlined, I think, recently in the Globe and Mail, the justice commitment and other commitments that have kind of languished. But they can't let go of this one. It's a voting issue. But the feds?
Well, actually, Canadians don't let the recession phase them out at all. You know, the prospect of a recession makes, you know, 77% of Canadians, three-quarters of Canadians, say that this is exactly the time you have to act. If you haven't acted in the last 10 years, better start acting now.
Yeah.
You know, to, again, reduce the number of poor. Well, maybe you can't during a recession, but you sure can prevent the number from rising.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, 60% of Canadians, more than 60% of Canadians, did not vote for the Conservatives.
Yeah.
Every single other federal party had a plan.
Yeah.
And spoke to poverty reduction in their plan. And Harper has been very clear that this time round, he can't turn around and trigger his own election and go back to the people. So it will be very interesting to see if poverty reduction does get on the agenda, because there was a flurry of activities at the federal level last year, too, not led by the Conservatives, but certainly pushed by other members of Parliament through committee work and through the Senate. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see if they get cornered into doing something, because there's going to be, all eyes are on the feds. How are you going to deal with this situation?
Yeah.
What are you going to do to stabilize the economy? And you know what? A poverty reduction plan actually does stabilize the economy.
Oh, sure. The money's a flow-through. Yeah, it's a flow-through.
Yeah, you know, everybody's talking about economic stimulus. Well,
yeah.
If economic stimulus is a tax cut, where does the money, just the sheer math of tax cuts, the way we do them in Canada anyway, goes to the top end of the distribution.
Sure.
And what do people with a lot of discretionary income do when they get a windfall? Well, they'll go on a vacation, which is offshore.
Yeah.
They'll invest in mutual funds, which is offshore. They'll buy highly, you know, expensive luxury items, which are primarily imported from offshore.
I see.
So we're actually sending our tax cuts offshore, which is not what you want to do in a downturn.
Right.
In a downturn, if you give money to people at the very bottom, they spend all their money. They don't have savings, so they spend every last penny of it, and they spend it on their rent, which is local,
yeah,
on groceries, which is local retailers and clothing, and on public transit. They spend it here. They spend it in the local economy.
Not offshore, but the corner store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you want to stabilize, because, you know, if those people stop spending and more people like them stop spending, it's the local retailers that go belly up, you know? It's the local jobs that get lost.
Yeah, and foreign conglomerates move in and ship more money offshore.
Yeah, so, you know, that's the most brain-dead way of spending, you know, if you want an economic stimulus, put it at the bottom.
Yeah.
But it's also a perfect moment for governments to do counter-cyclical investments. You know, if the cycle's going down in the construction industry, if you're on a downward spiral, hey, you know what we need? We need affordable housing.
Yeah.
What a great time to keep those good middle-income construction jobs and start building what we need a little bit more of anyway.
Yeah, and you can expect reasonable prices in a climate like this, too. I mean, it's
a good time
to spend, yeah.
Yeah, and in actuality, what you're doing is you're building an asset base for the next platform, like it's like a platform for the next phase of economic growth, right?
That's true.
And you're doing the things that are, you're not crowding out, it's a tight labor market, at least it was, you know, 6 months ago.
Yeah.
You're actually absorbing the unemployment. So you're actually keeping people working. These are these are good middle-income jobs, and that also helps keep the flow-through going.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds very sensible to me.
Yeah,
we have
smart
economics,
actually.
We have a few baby steps from the Conservative government in funding two or three housing programs that looked in danger.
Yeah, they kept that money going instead of cutting it. That's true.
Yeah.
What is really desperately needed now is increasing that money,
yeah,
number one. And number two, rolling forward some of the infrastructure projects that are on the books for, you know, 2-3 years down the road.
Yeah.
there would be no problem with moving those things forward and actually starting to invest. You know, if construction and building and infrastructure for the oil patch is down, we've got lots of temporary foreign workers that are in Canada right now because of those labor shortages that could be put to work elsewhere, as well as lots of Canadians that are losing manufacturing jobs. So
yeah.
There's no shortage of things that can be done, that need to be done, that have been deferred, first of all, because we had a deficit, and secondly, because we were growing too fast.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
now's
that's right,
the time
yeah.
to act.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think this Ontario Transit Initiative is going to get a boost from the recession and counter-cyclical spending, or do
it's
we know?
It's not clear how McGuinty is going to move forward through this period.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think they're trying to dampen expectations and manage them to say we're not going to do a lot more than we're already doing.
Right.
But again, there's a lot of pressure for them to do a bit more than they've been doing for sure. And that, you know, it's almost like a consensus there amongst the banking economists
yeah.
that, you know, said for decades, can't run a deficit,
oh,
must
yeah.
run a surplus. Suddenly they're saying, hey, you know, there's times when it's not so bad if you run a deficit, especially if you're building something.
Yeah.
If you're spending money on actually investing and building, again, a platform for the next phase of growth. And wouldn't transit fall into that category?
Yes, it would. Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious about the five steps to measure poverty relief. Do they tie into this sort of counter-cyclical spending scenario, or are they completely another world?
Well, they really want to see that the government sets clear targets and timelines. So what's your plan, Stan, is one of the tests. Show
yeah.
us the plan.
Yeah.
Show us a down payment on that plan.
Yeah.
Tell us how you're going to measure progress.
Yeah.
Report back to us and start doing something. Take
okay.
some steps somewhere.
Right.
So they're pretty minimal tests, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the government was all along, the provincial government anyway, was saying the big issue for them was how to measure it. So for sure we can expect something back from them. But the rest of it, the other four steps, where do we stand with those?
Oh, I think there is a huge amount of goodwill on the part of the minister that was selected to
Deb
head
Matthews.
Up this interministerial committee,
yeah.
Deb Matthews.
Yeah.
How much clout she has in cabinet, what the inner sanctum discussions are about what do we do now
mm-hmm.
that we're in trouble, you know, what kind of economic stimulus. Like just today in the news, they were saying that they're approaching the feds to help out the auto industry.
Right.
Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. But like if you're going to be focusing on something like the auto industry, you know that it's not clear how much emphasis you're going to put on poverty reduction. So we'll see what they do. I mean, it's like, I can't crystal ball it right now. Who knows what the pressures are going to be in the coming few weeks?
Yeah.
They said that in the early part of December, or sometime in December, they'll have a plan. And hopefully it'll be a great Christmas present for us all.
Oh, that would be nice. That would be nice. The work on the auto portfolio is important because of the terrific spin-off effects of the job losses there and the job gains that could be created. Does it directly address the question of today's poverty, or are we basically forestalling tomorrow's poverty by addressing the auto issue, or are we pouring money down a hole that the Japanese are going to fill anyway?
I have no idea what they mean by addressing issues in the auto sector.
Yeah.
It could be almost anything, Jeff,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know what
yeah.
it is that they have in mind. This is just something that I saw today. So
yeah.
undoubtedly conversations have been in the works for weeks and weeks, maybe
yeah.
months.
Yeah.
But I'm not clear on what that plan is.
Well, there's a training component. If it's not limited to the auto sector, it certainly could be broad relief for people who want training and want other jobs.
Indeed, and it could be investment in alternative designs and, you know, R&D and stuff like that.
A new industry, yeah, for sure.
There's 100 different ways of doing it. And, in fact, just not losing more jobs would be helpful. Do you know?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not in the auto industry, so I can laugh at that, but it's not funny.
Me neither. But, like, I mean, you could see them spinning this as we saved X number of good-paying jobs, and so we
yeah.
didn't make poverty worse. In
okay.
fact, you know, it would be a very challenging position to be in, to be a government that committed to poverty reduction at a time when there was no end in sight to the good times. And suddenly you've
uh-huh.
got this huge financial storm that is global in nature. There's no way you can control it.
Yeah.
But it will actually, you know, if they don't do something smart, it's going to increase the level of misery in this province quite dramatically.
Yeah.
So, you know, I certainly don't I don't envy them the position that they're in, but there are lots of different ways of approaching this moment, and we hope that they will be have a little bit more firmness in their spine. You know, this poll really does show most Canadians are behind them, most Ontarians are behind them in terms of income across all income spectrums.
Yeah.
In terms of political preference, every single party. I mean, there's almost no variation, particularly in Ontario, between age, income, and political preference. Ontarians are waiting for this government to act. They want to be proud of their premier.
Yeah.
You know, 88% of them say, make me proud. Be the premier that takes the leadership on this issue in the country. Captain Canada, you know? Everybody wants to have a leader that is principled and strong and does not forget the most vulnerable and does not forget that people other than bankers and investors hurt during economic downturns.
Do Canadians think they found such a person anywhere in the country?
Well, they're urging their leaders to be more courageous that way.
Yeah, yeah. So is it fair to describe the poll as a result as offering the politicians, you want more votes, here's one way?
Well, for sure this is one way. Absolutely. This is like, if you want backing, you've got it. You know, like people will stand behind you on this one.
Yeah.
The question, of course, is how much into a deficit should we... You know, on what basis should we run a deficit? But the truth is there, too, quite apart from popular sentiment, which I think is a little bit more cautious than even the economists are right now.
Yeah.
The economists are saying, this is exactly when you run a deficit. Like, don't be so scared.
Yeah.
But the proof is in the pudding. Run a deficit to do what? What are you buying with the money? If you're buying tax cuts, you know.
Yeah, you can't
here
eat
today,
tax
gone
cuts,
tomorrow.
Yeah.
But if you're buying investments,
In the next
round of growth, why not?
Yeah.
We all go into debt when we think we're investing in our own future, whether that's for schooling or whether that's for building a home.
When you think you can get a return, exactly.
Yeah. When you're building equity.
Yeah. Maybe the rumored Quebec election is going to show us what one provincial politician thinks they can do for the economy. Maybe it'll point the way. And maybe it'll show us how important this issue is, too. I mean, if he flubs the poverty issue, which I doubt he'll do, but if he flubs it and he loses, people will point and say, I told you so. And if he embraces it and he has a landslide win, people do the same thing. They'll point and they say, I told you so. Now he's next.
Well,
step up, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it really does depend on how our leaders frame it. They set the tone, you know?
Yeah.
And Canadians are way out in front of them on climate change and on poverty reduction.
Yeah.
And we're looking for leaders that will actually... think about these issues as like issues of our era. You know, growing inequality during a period of almost unprecedented prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it would be clear. You know, it is unprecedented. The amount of cash that's sloshing around our system, we've never seen anything like it. We've grown dramatically, and yet we can't seem to make things better. We're worried about what schools we're going to, what rinks we're going to keep open, what pools we're going to keep open. You know, our parents built those rinks and pools with a fraction of the amount of income that we have now.
Yeah, and probably more political will than we've had up until now.
Yeah, so let's hope that, you know, it's true that the moment south of the border is a bit of a game changer. You know, for the last 30 years we've heard that governments are the problem and markets are the solution, and certainly nobody can say that with a straight face right now.
No.
So we're looking at how will governments be the solution, not if they will be.
Very good. Yeah, very good. And maybe that Quebec election will give us some kind of clues as to what's in the offing for the future for other politicians who want to emulate a great success or who want to avoid a great loss, whichever occurs.
Sounds right to me.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on the phone, and especially in the evening when you've got to be out of the house and gone. You know, you're under the gun.
Yeah.
Thanks very much,
okay.
Armin.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Senior Economist with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, Armin Yalnizian, discuss the center's poll of Canadians, which revealed that 90% of them want their leaders to do something about poverty in Canada right now. And now to conclude the show, we have Khadr Biluni, over 1,000 days in confinement, awaiting approval of his second immigration application in Montreal.
So Halloween's coming up. What's going on in Montreal?
Good question. Good question, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, sometimes I open my internet and I can open some videos. I know the pictures, like I just talking about the picture. Sometimes I don't understand.
Yeah.
Because I can't see, and
yeah,
I can't understand what you're talking about. Why you talking about the pictures? What mean? And
yeah, why don't you talk about what happened? Yeah.
Yeah, and like I feel. That's why I sometimes just say open the radio. I'm listening like just yeah. the audio.
Yeah.
To make me more comfortable. I listen to news like and the audio.
Tell you the truth, I mean, I depend on my site for the audio editing that I do here on the computer, but I really prefer the radio to the television. I prefer to use radio is more like books. You know, you have to put your what you hear together with the pictures in your own mind.
Yeah.
So you have to use your imagination. And it's, I find it more rewarding. I find it more stimulating to listen to the radio than to watch the TV.
Actually, when you're blind,
yep.
if you can't see the picture and if you want to listen good news to understand easy, go to the radio.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing. I'm listening to the radio and I understand my news better and then I'm listening to news
yeah.
and the TV. Because the TV sometimes just shows the picture.
Yeah.
And for somebody can see, the picture makes sense.
Yeah.
But for me,
yeah.
I can't see. It's when you can't see, you can development like mini thing, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like I understand news very like easy
yeah.
than before. Before I was like with my vision.
Really?
Because now I'm listening and just because. I feel like I have to open my ear good, and that's it.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's it.
Yeah, a lot of sighted people don't feel they have to, quote, open their ears. They just talk.
Yeah, I'm not, I prefer to listen
yeah.
a lot,
yeah.
and I talk a little bit. BC here, Radio Canada?
Yeah, often CBC.
We had some before the news started in the radio.
Yeah.
They say, listen before you see.
Oh, okay.
It's good sense. Good sense, isn't it?
Okay. And this was, you heard this where?
This is Radio Canada.
They said that there. Listen before you see.
Listen before, yeah, listen.
Wow.
Écoutez avant, voir.
Okay, yeah.
Like, I know many, many persons doesn't understand nothing. It's like, and because he just sees the picture and doesn't open his ear.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Maybe government likes it that way? Do you think?
Yeah. Of course. Many governments like...
yeah.
And the world love the population just like...
Yeah.
Just see without understand.
Yeah. Okay.
The government loved that. Yeah.
Okay.
Many government on the wall loved that. Like,
yeah.
They need the population just like.
Oh, I'm. It's funny.
Without understand.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to the people who provide my income, the disability people, and I said today, you know, I'm having trouble with my landlord. You know, if I have to go out of the apartment to get food because there is no fridge right now, do you pay for it? She says that depends. I said, oh, so it's not sure thing. She says, no, you have to talk to us about it. So I said, well, then I have to hire someone to make the landlord provide the fridge. She goes, no, we don't cover that. The government is a funny thing these days.
I'm thinking the election, provincial election is going to be here too in
yeah.
Quebec. Do you hear about that?
What do you hear in Montreal?
And the election is going to be next month.
Yeah, that's what.
For election.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah, but the liberal, because here also we have minority like government.
Yeah, yeah. The liberals are a minority.
But,
yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think so. It's gonna be same. I'm thinking the liberal are gonna be like they're gonna be took the majority this time.
Oh, you think the liberals will get a majority?
Like, you know, when you ask people.
Oh, polls.
Yeah,
yeah,
and like has the majority.
Okay.
They has the majority. Like today, like they give like 42 to liberal and
oh.
and 30,
oh.
30, 30, 32 for the biggest. And Action Democratic League has only 14%.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, he's going to be lost the officer position.
Okay. Yeah. So you think the Liberals will win? All right.
Yeah, but like Action Democrats said, oh, this is like nobody ready for election.
Yeah.
I know he have to protect
He's
in like seats.
Yeah.
But I think Shahid want to go for election.
Yeah. Oh, why not?
Yeah. I think he want to go to election.
Yeah.
Shahid, he was conservator, you know?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he switched.
It's not switched for federal, he switched for provincial, you know?
Yeah. Big frog, little pond.
You know, last week, two MPs from Party Democrats went with the Liberal.
No!
Like you move, yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, wow. The last week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's moved with the Liberal and like, yeah.
Wow. The politicians did their own poll. They decided to go Liberal.
yeah. Decide because like he see like the population and think no more to give them the vote.
Yeah.
That's when he won the project, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see, eh? Christmas time, your present is a new government. What is Christmas like for a Muslim in Montreal, in confinement in a church in Montreal?
I hope this Christmas I'll be free.
Yes. That would be a nice gift, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be a very nice gift, yeah. And I feel like it's going to be happen.
You have a feeling that you're...
I have a feeling, yeah. I have a good feeling.
Okay.
I have a really, really, really good feeling. I have no concrete, you know?
Okay. Do your Catholic friends, do they extend gifts to you at Christmas time?
You know, my friend, every friend, like, call my friend, like, to be with the family, and,
yeah.
You know?
But did they give you gifts at Christmas or no?
Yeah.
They do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But, like, you know, Christmas, I'm always on by myself.
Yeah.
I'm staying in my room. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
What is Christmas Day this year? What day is that?
No idea.
Okay.
I'll be honest, no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, the day is the same, you know?
Okay.
I know today 28th because I was talking with my friend before you called me, and she talked to me about another friend, it's her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I know today is 28th.
Yeah.
Because my friend, she talked to me about another friend, and
mm-hmm.
That's it. I know today 28th, but every day for me, it's every day it's the same, you know?
Yeah.
For me, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, the 25th is the day my show is airing.
Yeah?
Yeah. So if you wanted to, I could come in on the 24th or the 25th and record you and put it into the noontime show.
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Yeah, we could do New Year's with Cutter, too.
Yeah.
We could, yeah. The 31st is a Wednesday. That won't be difficult. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention while we're on the phone today? Your needs, your health needs, your information
okay.
needs?
Yeah, just like I want everybody to pray for me.
Pray for you? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I want.
Okay.
And we hope we got good news next days.
All right. And I hope you take your cell phone with you so we can call you when you're out.
For sure, I want to stay my cell phone with you.
Yeah, good.
This number, I would never use it.
No, I don't think so.
No, that's
good.
Yeah, this number, I have many friends to call me in.
Yeah.
No.
Good.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
All right.
Take care, Jeff.
Yeah, take care. We'll talk to you next week, and we'll keep you in mind as the snowy season comes upon us.
Do you know the mini companies, the U.S. the cell phone gonna be here, like gonna be open, gonna be working in Montreal.
Many U.S. companies will be working in Montreal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for cell phones.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. All right. Well, then maybe they'll be here, too. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care.
Steel Rail, co-written by Lucinda Shodan and Ellen Shizko. Closing time.
She locks the door, turns off the light. Sorry we're closed, is what the sign says to the night. She counts the cash, it doesn't take long. Looks out the window and wonders where the years have gone. There was a time when the jukebox played all night. Boys are gone, they're women too. And when they closed the plant outside of town, the songs fell silent too. Billy tried for something new, but no one wanted a man 20 years at the plant, so he left too. Left is what she sees, a quiet cafe on an empty street that's dark with memories. She takes her bag, she's going home, a lonely shadow on the street where there's no one left to meet. She walks alone.
If you'd like to be aware a day or two in advance of what the disrespect topic is, if we know a day or two in advance, we'll email you, but you have to email us first. Dialogue@inbox.com, dialogue@inbox.com, for your update on what's coming on disrespect. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.com. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.